This is a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.
Well, good afternoon and thank you all for coming. This is the second in our series of distinguished speakers in law, psychology, and human development. Today's speaker, as a lot of you know, is Professor Reed Hasty. He's Robert Hamada, Professor of Behavioral Science at University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business. He holds a PhD in psychology from Yale, a master's from UCHD, and he did his undergraduate work at Stanford. Before assuming his present position, he was professor at Harvard, Northwestern, and the University of Colorado for some years. Along with one other person in this room, Professor Hasty is one of the original JDMers. In research and deep thinking, he's been hugely productive by any standard. His contributions to the interface between cognitive psychology and law are going to no doubt be the work that's most familiar to folks in the audience. And it was that work that prompted us to ask him to honor us with a presentation today. Professor Hasty was not only kind enough to accept, but his advanced publicity, he's just published, edited a special issue of one of the lead journals in the area, Journal of Behavioral Decision-Making, that deals with decision-making in the law. What you may not know, however, is just how broad his research contributions have been, really spanning the whole intellectual space of modern cognitive psychology. I can perhaps best illustrate the catholicity of his work with a personal anecdote. Over the years, there have been, as I recollect, four distinct occasions on which I was deep into some new research domain, only to discover that he'd already contributed some very fundamental work that answered most of the questions that I was interested in. The first time was actually in the 1970s when I was deep into repetition effects, and I think it was Rudy Schultz told me something like, gee, there's a couple of nice JEP papers on this by some guy named Hasty, which I then read. The second time was several years later when I was into finite algebraic models of recall, and they happened to make a very neat prediction about wiggles in the learning curve that that exponential models couldn't handle, but reciprocal models could. And I happened to tell Al Pavio about this, and he said, gee, there's a nice paper in Psych Bulletin on this by some guy named Hasty. Quite a few years later, I was doing some research on the memory independence effect in reasoning. It was a really fundamental effect which attracted me mainly because it heaped burning coals on the heads of all known theories of reasoning. So I thought it would be worth writing a psych review paper on it. I no sooner mentioned this to my wife, and she said there was this very eminent social psychologist named Hasty, who had appeared to discover much the same effect in social judgment and had a drop-dead psych review article on it. I think my reaction at the time was, what? I thought he was a math modeler. My last example came a few years later after Steve Cici had convinced me that psych law was in need of a serious infusion of cognitive psychology. No sooner had I decided to move in that direction when my wife told me that this same eminent social psychologist had contributed most of the important work in that vein, and that if I didn't want to sound more than usually stupid, I better read it up. So that didn't sound too bad, but as I started to do my homework, I discovered that he'd apparently been writing with both hands in his sleep. The first paper I discovered was a very savory piece that appeared in Psych Review on jury simulation back in 1980, and after that there was sort of an avalanche of JPSP articles and Psych Bulletin papers and Psych Review papers and Law Review articles and so on. So. And then there were the books, of course. So I decided at that point that the memory side of the law was for me. So there you have it. He's a memory researcher, he's a math modeler, he's an eminent social psychologist, and he's a leading psych law researcher. So I rest my case for catholicity. Today, he's going to talk to us about explanations for everything, a title that sort of leads me to suspect he's about to morph into a quantum theorist. Read it.
Well,
(clears
That introduction was certainly generous to a fault. When I saw this poster, which is surely the nicest poster, most elaborate poster that's ever been prepared for a talk I've given, I thought, wow, this is really going to be a good talk. But then I had this sort of sinking feeling about being too close to it. As you can see, I'm going to try to present a talk that's organized autobiographically and is focused, you know, when you get older, you try to find some theme that could tie all of these preposterously unrelated topics together. And the theme I'm going to sort of pursue is mental representation, and mental representation in the form of explanations. And, whoops, wrong way. I assume this is a pretty general audience. And when I got the invitation for the talk, I thought a very general talk that tried to explain what cognitive psychology is about might be appropriate. And some of you know even more than I do about what cognitive psychology is about, but I'll bet half the audience thinks it's a funny little field where people do these endless, intricate, repetitive experiments on tiny effects that have to do with reaction times and error rates and recognition memory. And so I'm going to introduce cognitive psychology, and at the end I'm going to try to talk, I won't have a strong punchline, about why I think it's a fundamental field that could provide some unification and connections between other fields. First of all, at the heart of it is this computer metaphor that the way people think is a little bit like the way a computer computes. And I think that is an essential part of the approach, and I buy into it. One's always a little nervous because throughout the history of thinking and philosophizing about how the human mind works, people have relied on the current tangible metaphor for some kind of a process that might be like a mental process, from the way gears transmit force in a mechanical system to the way hydraulic systems could make limbs move in medieval statues to telephone switchboards, and now the metaphor is a computer. And I guess I don't think that's stupid, using the most technologically sophisticated metaphor you have as a way to understand how things like minds, and in this case, minds might work like computers. But you're always a little bit suspicious of buying into those metaphors carelessly. Let me talk about a cognitive analysis that's a huge success, and that's mental arithmetic. I'm not going to embarrass anybody in the room by asking them to do this incredibly challenging problem out loud. It is an incredibly challenging problem, right? If we took it to a non-westernized, non highly civilized society, you know, a jungle or a veldt or a desert, we'd find people couldn't do this, right? This would be way over their heads. It took a long time to come up with the intellectual technology to solve these problems, and we spend a lot of time teaching members of our cultures how to do it. So it isn't a trivial accomplishment. And instead of making one of you do the problem on your feet, let's see if I can show you something funny, which is a mathematician doing the problem. Not sure the sound will work, and for some of you this will be a trip down memory lane. When I was a boy, this was one of the funniest guys I thought in the world, a mathematician named Tom Lehrer, long dead. Let's see how he does the problem.
You can't take 3 from 2. 2 is less than 3, so you look at the 4 in the tens place. Now that's really 4 tens, so you make a 3 tens, regroup, and you change a 10 to 10 ones, and you add to the 2 and get 12, and you take away 3, that's 9. Is that clear? Now instead of 4 in the tens place, you've got 3, because you added 1, that is to say 10 to the 2, but you can't take 7 from 3, so you look in the hundreds place. From the 3, you then use 1 to make 10 ones, and you know why 4 plus minus 1 plus 10 is 14 minus 1, because addition is commutative, right? And so you got 13 tens, and you take away 7, and that leaves 5. Well, 6, actually, but the idea is the important thing. Now go back to the hundreds place. You're left with 2, and you take away 1 from 2, and that leaves... Everybody get 1? Not bad for the first day.
Okay, well, so what's the point? Well, I could have asked one of anybody in this room to do the problem, and it probably wouldn't have sounded exactly like Tom Lehrer. You probably would have had a different, let's say, computational strategy, to say with the metaphor. but you would have almost certainly gotten the right answer through some route. An interesting property of problems like this is there's enormous cognitive variety in the strategies people use to solve them. So there's a big business of trying to figure out how people solve them. And this is a case where those think-alouds, those self-reports of what's going on in consciousness, are enormously informative about what's going on. And I'll bet if we had a think-aloud like that, we could predict the errors people make, we could write a computer program that would mimic the processing, mimic the what's being held in memory businesses, and basically mimic the computer that was educated up to solve these problems. And we'd find other people like me who do this problem in a much more mundane way, and we could figure out how they're doing it using that information. And this is a really good example for cognitive psychology, because I think cognitive psychology has really nailed mental arithmetic. And one proof of that is there are technologies in school systems that can, you know, with 5 or 6 diagnostic problems, figure out which arithmetic rules the child doesn't have and change their cognition with person-specific instruction and get them to do the computation exactly right. And I think that's, you know, a true cognitive analysis, an enormous success story. What does the cognitive theory have in it? It has 3 big parts. It has a summary of the processes, which for mental arithmetic are readily apparent. It has a summary, and there's often great disputes about what it really looks like in your mind or how it's coded in your nerves, of the mental representation that the processes are operating on. And then in the background for most of us, but in the foreground for the big general theorists, is what is the machine like that operates those processes and transforms the representations from one form to another to go from visually encoding that problem to an answer. Okay? And that's the cognitive enterprise, figuring out those 3 pieces. And most of us work on a subpart of the problem. There are some people who've devoted their lives to the general theory problem. What's the nature of the computer in your head? And now, as many of you know, those theorists, those researchers are heavily informed both by behavioral data and neural data. You want to make sure the machine could be implemented in the meat that's in your head. And then there are other people like me and other people in this room who have focused on, well, what do the mental representations probably look like? And I think, for me anyway, I'll say some things about it, but we've really not developed the process story completely. You know, lives are too short, and we usually focus on parts of the problem. But the big cognitive enterprise is to solve all 3 of those questions, you might say, for an important intellectual performance. And mental arithmetic is pretty important. We, you know, care about teaching it, and I'd say the cognitive analysis has really nailed the problem. If we go to something that I'll be talking about later, juror decision-making, everyday reasoning in an informal setting, maybe the cognitive people haven't nailed the problem, but they want to nail it the way they've nailed mental arithmetic. And I'm going to skip over these next slides. I guess they're for students who want to come back and study the downloadable slide set to get a sort of tutorial on the mental arithmetic theory. But there's, I think, emerging agreement about how to describe the processes. It's not complete agreement. Psychology is still a young field. Some people would rather describe the processes more mathematically, algebraically. Other people, like me, prefer more of a computational metaphor, like this so-called production system way of describing the rules that describe the processes. This is the beginning of a description of what the computer is like that uses rules like that to execute an arithmetic process. And then there's a lot of, you know, to an outsider, splitting hairs arguments about exactly what is the mental representation like for evidence from a jury trial. A lot of disagreement there. Much less disagreement about how do people represent numbers in their minds and in their brains. Little snapshots from a theory that I respect for mental arithmetic about what a mental arithmetic fact might look like if we could take a snapshot of it. And then what most of us learn in introductory cognitive psychology, guesses about what that computer looks like. Usually they come under the buzzword of what does the architecture of the mind look like. And this is an old one that probably most of, if you took a cognitive psychology course, you would have run into with a sort of a central processor or working memory and some buffers that hold information that's being processed in various representational forms, some kind of a storage for sensory input, long-term memory. A more modern view has more processes and more buffers. This is updated to 2007. It gets a little more complicated, and I'm not going to talk about these theories, but that's what, you know, that's the beginning of a lecture on what does the machine in your head look like. And I only put this diagram up. It's a variation on the diagram on the slide before, but you can see people are starting to make guesses about where in the brain the different subprocessors are located. So if someone's studying a problem where they think working memory is crucial, they might actually take measures of the activity in your dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, because there's a lot of evidence that that's the part of the brain that's most active when you're doing working memory stuff. Working memory would be the production system area. They've got new labels for things. Anyway, you get the idea of the general enterprise. We're going to answer those three questions. What's the machine look like? What do the processes look like that go on in the machine? And what's the stuff that's processed look like, the information? And what do we do then if we're cognitive psychologists? We conduct behavioral studies. If we're studying mental arithmetic, you can imagine what we do. We give people problems just like the one I gave Tom Lehrer. We have them think aloud. We measure the patterns of the errors they make. We look at their reaction times to look at problems that pose different, you might say, computational challenges. And we also look at brain activity more and more, eye movements if it's a task that's being performed with a lot of interaction with the stimulus. And then we try to model what's going on with an assumption about the processor, the architecture, the processes, and the representational systems. I'd really like to get into this lab. I just downloaded this picture from Brown University, but it makes it look really easy. You just put this vacuum machine on people's heads and suck out the cognitions. I really wish we were there. But as you'll see when I start describing my research, going from the theory, your hypotheses about the representations and the processes, and actually verifying, taking snapshots of what's inside the head, well, we don't have that cognitive camera yet. So I'm afraid in my field, there's a lot of ingenuity across this room. There's enormous amounts of ingenuity expended by all of the cognitive researchers coming up with actually what really look like to an outsider, a non-physicist or a non-biologist, ad hoc solutions to the how do you take a snapshot of the cognition's problem. And I'll just give some examples of my way of taking snapshots. Big problem is how to constrain the model, and the answer is more and more data. You know, not just the error rates, but the reaction times and the eye movements and the subtle patterns of errors, and maybe even some help from outside, some assumption that if there is a best way, that's nature's way. That's a quote from Aristotle. There are entire behavioral fields in animal research where that's just the assumption. The animals are optimizing. They've been selected by evolution and by personal learning histories to be optimal. All we have to do is fit an optimal model to their mating situation or their foraging situation. And that's all the theory we need. We won't even go inside their heads, so to speak. So some researchers use optimality as a guide to what computations must be going on inside the head. And finally, very new and very exciting to most of us, some people try to look at the neural activity. And you know, you can imagine how complicated it is. But if we have, and I think we really do have, nascent but far from conclusive ideas about which parts of the brain are which parts of the computer, you can look for differential activity as yet another constraint. Well, how does that work? In the ideal, everything is copacetic and cool and converges. The stories that the models tell about individual differences and development and the relation to evolutionary selection and adaptive optimality and the rational analysis at the top, and we look at how these skills are learned, and we do look a little bit at the neural implementation, and it all says you've got the right computational model. How often does that happen? I'd say it's pretty close to happening for higher level cognitive things like mental arithmetic. Is that happening for false memory? Is that happening for how jurors make decisions in legal cases. Not quite yet, but I think that's where we're headed. I'm a very optimistic guy. I think that's what's happening in all of these research lines, applied or laboratory. So what are the big successes? I think we really can nail certain kinds of attention and perception problems in very complicated tasks, like the way air traffic controllers perform. We know a lot about language acquisition, production, reading. Classroom instruction on things like mental arithmetic and programming skills and other logic-like achievements that are culturally trained, and certain kinds of expert skills, very task-specific. So I think we really know how chess masters do it. I think we know quite a bit about music expertise. There are all these numinists that historically have been baffling puzzles. You know, how can this person remember, how can an ordinary undergraduate remember 200 digits when they just hear them read one at a time in a random order? Well, I think we know how they do that now. And we know how they do it in terms of a description of the cognitive architecture, the representations, and the processes. Why is it necessary? Well, if everything really was optimal, if we were in that animal ecology, behavioral ecology field, they don't go the next step. If we were economists of most stripes, we'd just assume optimality was a good model and figure out what optimal meant and cut to that chase. And we'd discover very often that the stimuli-behavior relations were pretty well predicted by an optimal computation. But I don't think that always happens. Sometimes it doesn't happen because the representation of the situation is incomplete, or because the person hasn't had enough time to learn a better or an optimal-like strategy. So that's one reason we need cognitive psychology. Sometimes the information, even if it's all available and maybe even the learning has occurred, isn't processed optimally because we do have limited processing of various kinds. Sometimes it's just useful to link different levels of analysis. I'll make a pitch, but it's just going to be a testimonial, because I don't have time to try to prove it, but I think neuroscience endeavors are facilitated considerably by having a cognitive model in place in the first place to organize how they analyze working memory and try to relate brain function to the cognitive model. And then finally, there are just applications, mostly in education and what are called human factors engineering situations, where the cognitive analysis has just improved practice. So even if you didn't believe the theories and all the academic stuff that results from this, education is better because of the cognitive analysis. So that's why we might need it. Disclaimers, as I said, this is really a repeat of what I said before. I think the basic paradigm that drives almost all psychological thinking, we can find people who disagree, who believe that there's a type of mathematical model that isn't computational in this sense. We can find people who are struggling still to be behaviorist. We can find people who are just interested in describing the behavioral phenomena and not understanding or explaining it. But I submit, maybe it's just because I'm old and tired and things blur together, that the underlying paradigm for psychological interpretation in all fields of psychology is something like this cognitive metaphor. And of course we'll disagree on details of which analyses were most successful and exactly how is that cognitive architecture laid out and so on. But I think there is a basic information processing cognitive paradigm that underlies 90% plus of today's psychology. But as I said at the beginning, most people only address a fraction of the problem. They either address what's the general theory like, or they focus on one issue that has to do with working memory and the brain, but they don't deal much with representation or processing, or you name it. No one can do the complete analysis, and it's like any of the advanced sciences that we're moving towards. It takes an enormous number of people to solve the full problem. Humble beginnings is where I started. I did my fabulous repeated word studies that impressed Chuck so much when I was even younger. Would love to give you a lecture on intralist repetition effects and free recall learning, but it just didn't seem like most of you would want to go down that road. When I got out of the memory for lists of words business, I wanted to do research that would get me off campus and make contact with everyday experience a little more than the memory for lists of words research, which of course is fabulous and exciting and was my first love in psychology, but I just don't think I can talk about it today. So I wondered, there was a lot of social psychology in those days, just after graduate school for me, on how do people form impressions of other people. And so I did a number of experiments in this genre, and it was actually not a breakthrough, but it was my distinctive contribution was to say, if we wanted to take a snapshot of the mental representation of information you have in your head that represents another individual person, what would the organization of that memory look like? You know, would it have images in it? Would it have, you know, sort of impressions of how good or bad the person was? Would it have little, like, narrative snapshots or vignettes in it? What would it look like? I was still heavily driven by the old laboratory paradigm, so I studied fictional characters that I created in the laboratory, and I'd describe them with short film clips, or I'd describe them with lists of sentences that described things they had done. My early experiments, I made a terrible error and used the names of fellow graduate students and famous psychologists in my stimulus materials. I thought it was cute. So there's a lesson here for graduate students. What happens at the end of the term is you run out of subjects from the regular subject pool. So you turn to the other graduate students and you say, "Won't you be in my study?" So they get in the study, and some of you will get the joke. They learn material about Jim Bartlett, but they know Jim Bartlett. They see him every day. Or they learn material about Roger Brown and Gordon Bauer. I thought it was real funny when I wrote the material. I think I used James Cutting in these studies, but he didn't get in the graph in the published article. Anyway, that's a real mistake, because then people, they show definite interference between what they really know about James Cutting and what they learned about James Cutting and Jim Bartlett in the experiment. But anyway, poor Jim Bartlett was shown rescuing a kitten, adopting a child, causing an accident, and losing his temper at a sales girl. And so what's the point of these studies? Well, I tried to find questions that were in the literature. So one point I addressed is, what happens if you have a piece of information about a person that contradicts your general impression? So what if you think Jim Bartlett is generally a nice guy, but then you learn he loses his temper and yells at the sales girl? That stands out. It's, you could say, informative or incongruent or surprising. Well, in those days, almost all the theories said what was well remembered was what fit the general concept, what fit the impression. But what I discovered very early wasn't a total surprise. It was anticipated by other results in memory. It was the surprising events that were best remembered. And so even if events were, if you controlled for all the properties of the events, including frequency and presentation, vividness, and all the rest of it, it was distinctive stuff that was best remembered. And it also had the biggest impact on your overall judgment of what kind of person this was and what they would do. So I addressed that kind of question. In that case, my conclusion was that an incongruent event, like the circles in this very schematic, very old published graph, would get linked to more other information you knew about the person, because you'd think about them longer. Gee, that's funny. I didn't know he'd lost his temper. And you'd try to explain them. So we're going to get finally to my theme that explanations drive a lot of memory representations. And so thinking about the puzzling stuff that needed to be explained would link it to more other information in memory and make it better remembered. So this is a very modest beginning, where I was looking at putatively a judgment or a decision. Would you want a room with Jim Bartlett? Would you rate Jim Bartlett as high or low on the nice person scale, the morally correct scale, and how that was related to memory, and in particular how there was this funny interaction between informative and well-remembered information. I then tried to generalize that, and it's really Roger Tarangio, the second author paper listed up there, who took this further, and he applied it to how people think about significant people that are, in a sense, fictional to us because we rarely meet them, people we read about in the media, political candidates. And there are a host of phenomena that are in the political evaluation in surveys, literature. You know, you ask people, do you support George Bush, or do you prefer Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton? And that's the kind of decision or judgment that this application was directed to. And what Taranjo proposed was a network model very much like the one I'd proposed, but a little richer because he's not looking at these dull fictional laboratory characters. And what he did is try to explain some phenomena in political polling. That is, these impressions are very labile for most citizens, and they're very heavily dependent on the context of the questions that have been asked earlier in the survey. So if you ask questions about foreign policy, you get one evaluation of Barack Obama, and if you ask questions about health care just before you ask the evaluation question, you get different questions. So we wanted to explain lability, systematic context dependence of evaluations and surveys, and he proposed a model, he's a colleague of mine, that was based on this tired old network model. Notice this is a relatively unstructured model. We call it croutons and cognitive soup. And for most people, for most political candidates and most political issues, that's what their memories look like. And that's a good explanation, if we could take a snapshot in their heads, of why their opinions are so labile and unstable and move around so much. Now, when you get to people who really think hard about an issue, for instance, I've thought long and hard about the death penalty and capital punishment and testified as an expert in many cases, we move from croutons in the cognitive soup, which is probably the way I thought of the death penalty before I'd become an expert, towards a more systematic network, and finally to a very highly structured memory structure on that issue. Ditto for someone who's really enthusiastic about Barack Obama or John McCain. They have a much more systematic, less soup-like representation. And Taranjo then went on and tried to use this representational interpretation to explain political evaluations. So that's my first example of mental representation used to explain something, in a way, outside the laboratory. I'm going to skip the next slides. The talk would go on too long with them, and they get technical. But they have to do with the specifics of a model that talks about how you generate the evaluation when you sample from networks of various forms. So now we get to probably the main course for most people in this room, and that's the research I've conducted on jury decision making. Let me make a disclaimer I should have started the talk with. All of this work is collaborative. I'm up in front of you. I'm getting all the credit. I had the brilliant introduction. But all of this work was done with many other people. The other people, in many cases, contributed more than I did to what's good in the research. And this is also work that was going on at other laboratories, and I was interacting with people outside of my lab. So it isn't just me, 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 even though, as I talk, it'll sound, as it always does, like me, me, me. Let me talk about mental representations of evidence in jury trials, which is probably what I'm best known for. The question is, how do jurors get this incredible cognitive task? You might say much harder than mental arithmetic if you do it well, and they haven't been trained up except by everyday experience to do it. They didn't go to second grade and learn to do subtraction. So how do they do it? And are there, a first guess would be, well, jurors are pretty confused. The evidence comes in incredible volume and rate and in very confusing, often contradictory, interrupted. You can't imagine a worse way, well, you could imagine an even worse way, but not much worse way of presenting information on which to make a decision. And yet, maybe they have cognitive soup too, and the evidence just bobs around in it. Is there any more structure than that? So let me start with a laboratory demonstration. It's not as funny as the mental arithmetic, but I want you to be in my little experiment and try to figure out what's going on in the situation described by these sentences. The struggling company developed an expensive drug to treat high blood pressure. The rock rolled down the steep mountain and crushed the tiny hut. For a certain generation of psychologists, this will start to evoke laughter. The construction foreman gave the female welder defective oxygen tanks. The huge rock rolled down the steep mountain and crushed the tiny hut. FDA approval was received for the drug to treat high blood pressure in pregnant women. The tiny hut was at the edge of the pine forest. The macho construction foreman gave the female welder defective oxygen tanks, and she went to repair the rusted roof supports. The company received FDA approval for the drug to treat high blood pressure in pregnant women. The huge rock crushed the tiny hut. The female welder, with the defective oxygen tanks, went to repair the roof supports. The struggling company received FDA approval for the expensive drug. The welder went to repair the rusted roof supports. The huge rock rolled down the steep mountain and crushed the tiny hut at the edge of the forest. The macho construction foreman sent the welder to repair the rusted supports. The struggling company received FDA approval for the expensive drug it had developed to treat high blood pressure in pregnant women. Okay, what have you got in your heads? Not a bunch of loose cognitive croutons, right? You have memories of three situations. Situation with a female welder, a situation with the poor tiny hut, and a situation with a struggling drug company, right? So this is stuff we comprehend all the time. And so let's go to the memory test. Which sentences did you hear? Play the game. Let's go for a familiarity type response, or not a recollection test. How many of you remember hearing the first sentence? Come on, play the game. Raise your hands if it feels like you heard it. The rock crushed the tiny hut. Second. Macho construction foreman gave the female welder. Huge rock rolled down the steep mountain. Female welder went to repair the rusted roof supports. The company received FDA approval for the... Valerie and Chuck said that Fuzzy Trace... Yeah, okay. Well, good. I'm glad we got some of those. Well, Valerie and Chuck are saying, oh, fuzzy trace theory explains this whole experience. I mean, this is as pure gist as you can get. Not much verbatim left in this situation, and your recognition responses are based on a general familiarity with the gist of the three situations. It's easy to score this test because none of these were presented, right? What you heard were different parts of the schemas, and we all can recognize that what our mind is doing is adaptively very important, and we couldn't get around the world if our eyes didn't do this with its saccades as we view visual scenes, if our brains didn't do this with information that came through all of our senses, our haptic senses and everything. It creates models of the situation we're in. We won't go back and say these are exactly analogous to the models we create of political candidates or people we meet, but the idea is that what the memory system wants to do functionally is create mental models of important entities in the situations we're in, or not just entities in this case. These aren't, you know, the point is these are gist, but they're not just gist. They're just in the form of narratives, very sketchy, prototypical, schematic narratives, right? And that's what our brains do. And that's very adaptive, right? Where would you need a memory for verbatim stuff? Well, on a test, on the witness stand, maybe when you're fighting with your partner about who said what to who at the last party, but there aren't too many places where you really need the verbatim stuff to navigate around the world. So this is probably a very sensible way for your brain to work. I'm not going to go through all the details of it, but there's a lot known about how this kind of schematic creating gist in the form of narratives work. There are little effects that are known for it, just like my coherent memories for people, exceptions to the stories. If I had something funny in the, something really vivid or distinctive in the female welder story, that would be especially well remembered, that part. There are amount of information effects, completeness effects, both in the test sentence, the more complete it is, the more familiar it feels. That makes very simple sense. And also effects that have to do with the amount of information in the original experience, how confident you feel you know what was going on and things like that. And in a very metaphorical level, this all resonates with what many of you know about what makes an eyewitness testimony accurate or persuasive. Or on the other side of the coin, what makes sense to a juror is persuasive, and so on. So after not doing studies like that, but doing, I'm going to talk about very quickly autobiographical, the jury decision research I did, primarily with a colleague named Nancy Pennington and with another student named Steve Penrod and with another postdoc named Rob McCoon. And to jump to the chase, what we decided is that in a typical criminal trial, we have a civil trial story too, what the juror does is they hear evidence very much like the stories you heard. It comes in fragments. Different witnesses repeat things other witnesses have said and complete different parts of the overall schema about what went on. But what they're trying to construct is a summary of what happened. And in fact, they're instructed to do that. Figure out what happened. What's the historical truth? That's your job as jurors. Put together the pieces of the puzzle and find the facts. Then after they've done that, at the end of the trial usually, they first learn about these, to many of the jurors, surprisingly unfamiliar legal definitions of the crime categories that they're supposed to consider as decision options. Which category, first-degree murder, not guilty by reason of self-defense, does the story summary that they constructed and believe as credible fit into? And then the final step is to make that classification. And as I've already anticipated, I haven't really solved in a convincing way all parts of the problem. I can wave my hands. I've got fragments of evidence about the processes. But mostly what we've done, I think, is nailed the mental representation problem. So what Pennington and I showed, the first studies were really nightmares for, they'd really put a chill into a graduate student's heart, where we had jurors listen to realistically long trial transcripts or observe filmed reenactments of fairly realistic trials, 3 and 4 hour videotapes, and then tested their memory for the information that they'd heard, and used think-alouds during the process of listening to the trials and think-alouds while they were trying to reach a decision. And the evidence from all of that, when analyzed in a method that we can show to other people and allow them to systematically apply, we came up with snapshots of the stories that we thought were associated with different verdicts. So we kind of worked backwards from the decision. We took all the jurors in a particular trial who said, acquit the defendant, and we overlaid our, I could go into the details of the data analysis at any point, but I don't think many of you want to go there today. We basically created graphic summaries of the stories that the jurors had constructed. We actually weren't expecting stories necessarily, but they irresistibly came out of almost every juror's report of what they heard. When we'd ask jurors to answer questions in a non-story order, they would say, start, and then they'd say, well, let me just tell you how it happened. It was as though this is just like with those silly schemas about the welder and the tree and the tiny hut. They just couldn't resist using the narrative schema as the way to structure the information. If we took jurors who convicted, in contrast, their memory structures were very different. Like good little cognitive psychologists, we went on to verify those structures by asking the college student and the real jurors from realistic jury pools to answer questions, time their reactions, and so on. General convergence on the story structures that we got out. Very painful, painstaking, long, not very exciting research enterprise. We did actually learn, I think, some insights into the way trials work. For example, if we just looked at the prosecution evidence, we found a lot of nice linear stories. It's not a typical trial. It's a truly exceptional trial, the kind of trial that sets precedents and impresses citizens. But if you think about the O.J. Simpson trial, the prosecution told a nice linear narrative. Marcia Clark even summarized in her final argument to the jury with a timeline and told them the narrative story. How about Johnny Cochran? What did he summarize with? He had to tell 3 or 4 stories. He had to tell the story of what O.J. was really doing that evening. Then he had to tell the story of where did all that evidence come from? He had to tell the story about the corrupt police officers. And then finally, although he didn't really have the evidence for it, he did tell the story, even in his closing argument, about who really killed Nicole Brown. And so it was, you might say, stories. But the observation is that in most cases, on the criminal side anyway, the prosecution has the nice, coherent story. There are other reasons they win more trials, but that 80 or 90% conviction rate is partly there because they have a much easier rhetorical problem, evidentiary problem, whereas the defense, really, if they're going to do its job to satisfy what we all want to know about what happened, almost always has to tell more than one story. Well, that's just a side observation. After we'd analyzed 7 or 8 cases, we started to see this, that, gee, the prosecution always has one story. The defense, if they take a story track, has several. Yeah?
Is this per person, or is this...
No, the only... Well, what we did is we used group data to figure out what the prototypical story was. Then we went back to individual mock jurors who come in after we've extracted the story, and we verify for each one of them with the individual methods that if they said convict, their memory structure looks like that prototype. It was never perfect. As I say, the job of taking cognitive snapshots of inside people's heads is never easy. And there isn't a uniform method for identifying mental representations. I suspect eventually there'll be some convergence on that, that different labs, you know, when Stephen Cece is worried about the mental representation in a witness's memory, and someone else is worried about the representation in a juror's memory, and someone else is interested in, you know, yet another person's mental representation, there'll be a lot of convergence on how do you make a convincing claim. But right now, to an outsider like a biologist or a physicist, our methods are very ad hoc looking, and Stephen will use a different method, and, you know, James will use another method, and I'll use yet another one. It'll be very context specific.
Well, I think I can think of is when you're actually picking for a trial, they usually try to kick out anyone that has predispositions for anything that's going to be discussed in the trial.
Yep.
So here you actually used like a random selection of people. Is it possible that those that chose to convict had less of this crouton and assume like theory about what was going on coming into the study?
Well, that definitely doesn't derail me, but I don't want to try to give a long answer because I think I'll just start to meander. These are cases, we actually did do a quick and dirty voir dire, so we could identify jurors who would have been eliminated in a real voir dire in a case where there was no pretrial publicity or anything like that, because these are cases where they could never have heard of the case. They weren't never appeared in the newspaper. They were run-of-the-mill cases. And these were, for the 7 or 8 I referred to where we did our initial analysis, they were our edited versions of real trial transcripts. And that's why we sort of believed our observation about how defense cases are typically different than prosecution cases in structure. I think there will be differences for people who come in with expectancies of various types. I don't think they'll come in with a template. I'll just give you a hint at the answer. They come in with background differences that lead them to make different inferences from the evidence. And in some cases, they're predictable. I'll give you one example. Just as in jury selection, we always got demographics on our jurors, and we tried to correlate that with the verdicts across our 8 cases. And what we found, let me just pick one case, there was a murder case where there was actually a fairly high correlation, 0.3, I think, to 0.4, between social class and verdict. And we tried to zero in on what the difference was. And the lower, there was an issue in the case of why was he carrying a 12-inch knife if he didn't intend to stab the other guy. You know, he said, I just went out to the bar for a drink. But as far as we could tell from testimony, it was ambiguous in the real trial and our case. He didn't have a knife when he'd had a quarrel with the person. But now, suddenly in the evening, he's got this 12-inch knife. Why did he have the 12-inch knife? Well, people from higher social classes say, that's a really distinctive event. He must have had a special reason to be carrying a 12-inch knife in the evening. He must have been looking for the guy. And what did the lower class people say? Oh, it's just insurance. Why, I have a knife with me right now. And some of these studies were carried out in pre, you know, metal detector days, and jurors would, just like in 12 Angry Men, pull knives out of their purses and say, I just carry it in case. Anyway, you get the idea. We weren't looking for those differences, anyway, I won't say we've nailed jury selection or pretrial biases, but it gives you an idea. This is not a surprise to trial lawyers, including Johnny Cochran, although the detailed kind of analysis and the particular methods to take snapshots were something of a surprise, but you find constant references to this. And if you read trial tactics books, I believe there's actually a small filter-down impact of this research that they now, I think, feature to a greater degree than they did when we did it. But they talk about the narrative rhetorical tactic as a trial tactic. And there are two or three tactics that are pushed in most How to Make Your Arguments books. One of them is be sure to tell a narrative. One of them is take the points to prove in the verdict you want and organize your witnesses and your arguments to convince everybody you've proved the key points. A third, and then these are law people, so you know how nutty they are. There's all sorts of references to the Nestorian order for the strongest dramatic effect from Greek rhetoric. And the notion is that you start with your second strongest argument and then present the weaker arguments and then finish with your strongest argument, and that will maximize impact. Well, there's probably some merit to all of these pieces of advice, but anyway, a lot of attorneys know that one effective strategy is stories. I can't go on and on because of time, but let me give an example of one key issue, and a key issue for all research, I think, on mental representation. We can often do studies in any domain, in the old verbal learning tradition, in, say, memory for advertisements, and so on, about what does the mental representation look like, but it's sometimes very hard to prove the mental representation is actually the medium or the vehicle for the effect on the decision. Can you prove that the mental representation of the advertising argument is what caused the person to choose the breakfast cereal? And of course, when we gave talks like this to audiences of cognitive psychologists, we were constantly ravaged by the questions about, well, you've shown there's a correlation. The people who said acquit have a story structure. Maybe they made that up after they reached their verdict. A very common image is the juror comes in, they take one look at the defendant, and they say, he's gone, which you can find often in transcripts of real jury deliberations. And, you know, then they come up with a story to tell, too, because that's what we do in this culture, or maybe they'll be asked in the jury room. So how do we prove the story is actually causing it? So we did a number of studies, but this is the most compelling and the most vivid. Remember in this study, every mock juror, these are college student mock jurors, so we always have a generalization issue. In almost all the studies I've talked about, most of the subjects are people sampled from jury pools. So they're real citizens with a real range of cognitive skills that you don't find in the university community, and also a real range of prejudice and other attitude differences that we're not used to seeing in college. But these are college kids. Everybody gets exactly the same evidence. So if they were rational calculators, there oughtn't to be any difference in their verdicts. And what we did was we manipulated how easy it was to construct the prosecution's story or construct the defense's story. So we simply varied the order of the evidence, and witness order refers to the order of the evidence in the original trial. So these are based on transcripts of original trials. They're edited considerably. I can provide materials and summaries of it. But they're sort of realistic fact patterns from real cases. And in the witness order, they're presented in the order that the lawyers chose in the original case. Usually, in a real trial, lawyers, these are run-of-the-mill cases. These are not O.J. Simpson cases or precedent-setting cases. These are transcripts of cases, you know, barroom brawls that end in stabbings and 7-Eleven robberies and, you know, assaults and things like that. Witness order is the order usually of when the witnesses were available. When can the cop come in and testify? When will the brother-in-law be able to take the witness stand? And in the other case, we just put them in chronological order. So we could take the prosecution case and present it in witness order, the original order, not usually the lawyer's fault, and usually pretty scrambled, or we could present it in a nice chronological story order. And our hypothesis is that everybody hears the same evidence ultimately, but whichever side of the case is in the witness order has the story order has the advantage, has the stronger chance of getting its mental representation in, and in turn that mental representation will cause the verdict. So these are the conviction rates for the jurors. Presented evidence, always identical evidence, both times in the story order. So the prosecution has its strong advantage order and the defense. The two halves of the case both come in story orders. And it's a pretty even case, this one. We use three cases, I guess, for generality. And here's the other balanced case. Both of them are in the disadvantaged order. Also fairly even, close to 50-50. But now we give the prosecution the story order advantage and disadvantage the defense with the witness order, and the verdicts for the prosecution jump to 78%. Really dramatic. Now we reverse it. Same defense evidence, but we give it in the advantaged order. Same prosecution evidence, but in the disadvantaged order, and conviction rates drop to 31%. Pretty dramatic effects. The kind of dramatic effects I doubt you'd get in a courtroom, especially with lawyers compensating for each other's trial strategies and so on. The kind of effect that does illustrate, I think, a pure mental representation effect. Another punchline, not the strongest punchline, I think, but in which condition do you think the jurors said, "I'm most confident in my verdict"? Well, a natural conclusion would be to say, well, when the verdicts are lopsided, that ought to be where one side or the other was stronger, so that's where they ought to be confident. So they ought to be highest confidence here or here. We might even go further and say, well, here the story order jurors are going to be the most confident they've got the right verdict. But the highest rating of confidence, quite a clear effect, was in the story cell, suggesting that when they had both sides in the story form, they thought, now I know what went on. Oddly, that's probably the most even cell in terms of the ultimate overall verdicts. Well, you get a flavor of the kind of research we've done on this stuff. Let me skip ahead. I won't do part of the talk. This is the general model we then came up with, and we argue that there's not all decisions are explanation-based, that is, based on a mental representation that explains the data or explains the evidence. But I think some of those person impression cases are explanation-based. I think much medical diagnosis is explanation-based, where the expert physician constructs a mental model of the patient and then infers the diagnosis from that representation. I think you can find decisions that are driven this way. I don't think they all are. And I think the modal juror decision is an explanation-based decision. So we went on with that theme. I'm going to skip this. This is work on mental representations for everyday categories. And let me very briefly talk about what I'm doing now. I'm looking at mental representations that people use to predict the next event in a sequence of events. So everybody is, I think, subject. This is what Amos Tversky said was the strongest judgment bias he knew. You see a roulette wheel come up black five times in a row, or you see a coin come up five times in a row heads. What's going to come up next? It's a natural tendency to say it's going to correct itself. It's time for a tail. I don't know how many weddings I've been at. Well, I do know. I've been at 5 weddings, which is a lot out of my total wedding experience, where some relative of someone has sat down next to me and said, "Professor, you study decision making, huh? I can tell you how you're guaranteed to make money in Las Vegas. Go to the roulette wheel, wait, you don't bet, just wait until red comes up 5 times in a row and put your money on black. you're virtually guaranteed to make money. If you keep betting like that, you're going to walk out with your pockets full. So that's what we call the gambler's fallacy, right? We're trying to predict the next event in the sequence of coin tosses. So just a summary. When we think a random mechanism is generating, when a family, a woman has born four boys in a row, we know the next child's going to be a girl. Roulette wheels, coins, things that we culturally type as random. There are funny everyday examples of this. People killing themselves and so on because they believe in the gambler's fallacy. Number 23 hadn't come up for 153 days in the Italian lottery, and people are betting their entire assets on it, killing themselves when they don't win. If we look at more mundane lotteries, this is the betting on a number one day after it won, 2 days after it won. It takes about 80 days for the betting level to return to its pre-winning level because people think it won, it doesn't have a chance to win. And then, you know, people complaining about their iPods not shuffling randomly enough, right? You know, you shouldn't get repeats, just like the coin repeats too much and the lottery doesn't repeat enough and so on. But then we go to another arena, which is very familiar at Cornell because Tom Gilovich was the lead author on these studies, and many of the studies were done with fans at Cornell. We see a basketball player hit 5 shots in a row, and the natural inclination for basketball fans is to think he's even likelier to hit next. If we were betting people, you know, the old fool at the wedding would lean over to me and say, if you want to have a really shrewd sports bet, go to a basketball game, and when the guy has hit 3 in a row, bet the guy next to you he's going to miss, and you're sure to win because he's going to hit. This is Tom, who's not in town today, and Amos Tversky wrote a classic paper on the hot hand error of judgment. And I believe that it is an error in judgment. It's very controversial. And there are different ways to explain it. There are some sports where there is true streakiness, but there's not in basketball as far as we can tell it statistically. And I have to say, some very smart statisticians have tried to rebut Amos and Tom's result, and they really seem to be wrong. And if we went to another sport like golf putting or archery or billiards, we'd find streaks. Where else do we find streaks? Pool, I said billiards, that's the same. Archery.
Baseball hitting.
I don't think that's true. I don't think baseball hitting, there isn't really much momentum in football teams. The general decider, actually if you want to come up with a theory for where the streaks really are, is in sports that are kind of placid and non-reactive. So golf putting, archery, billiards, darts, those are all, they're all accuracy kind of sports, but they're all sports where on each trial the performer has a very uniform field of play, no one interferes with her or him, and they take their shot, and you do get streaks, statistically valid streaks in those sports. Bowling, you also get streaks. The one exception, the weird one, I don't think is baseball, although it's always possible I missed a study, but I've just written a review of this, is hockey goaltending. Goaltenders tend to seem to have statistical streaks of saves. I can't explain that one, but everything else, you don't get streaks in the chaotic, reactive sports, you do in the placid ones. I won't go on about this, but Gilovich and Tversky have a really crazy, nutty explanation for the hot hand effect. And I won't just, you know, I could make Tom look so stupid when he's not here, but I won't go down that road. But what I think is when people go into these situations, they have a mental model of what the generator is like that produces these events, and they have a very different concept of what a basketball player is like as a mechanism compared to what a mother giving birth or a roulette wheel is like. Doesn't really take too much cognitive psychology to persuade people that people have somewhat different images of those different devices, and that they use their belief about what the mechanism is like, I'm going to say their mental representation of it, to predict and explain streaks and non-streaks. This is I don't really have time to go into details, but we've been conducting studies of basketball fans, and what we discover is that the fan in the control group who goes into a basketball game with no expectancies about what's going to happen goes in either, well, neither, let's see, let me get, this dependent variable is how hot do you think the player is, including how streaky do you think the player is, and there are subject, the player they're actually looking at is not hot. These are edited basketball championships, films from high school basketball games in Nebraska, or the player is actually hot. And if we just look at the control player who goes in with no expectation, if the player's not very hot, they conclude that player wasn't very hot. And when they go in expecting the players, when they go in and see the hot player with no expectancies, they say that player was streaky and hotter. And the person who goes in expecting that this is a recruitable player, that a college basketball team, they were told, is thinking of recruiting the player to perform on their team, the player doesn't perform very well. That expect he's going to be hot, that's damped down by the player's performance. He's actually hot, that goes up. So what we find is that people who expect players to be hot perform the same way in their judgments as the players who have no expectancies. And the players who expect the player is going to be cold show an expectancy effect that makes them different from the the non-expectancy player. I'm not describing the study very well. But our basic conclusion is that if the control group is sort of the base rate of how a person makes judgments of basketball player with no expectancies, they respond to less hot and hot performances. And the people who think the player is going to be hot look like them. And so we conclude that the natural sort of expectation of a basketball fan is like the person who thinks there are going to be hot streaks in basketball. I mean, we're doing other studies on this. This is very early in the research. But our claim is they're not walking in, the way Tom Gilovich might say, expecting the player to be random, but they're walking in expecting that basketball players are streaky. The tough problem, and I won't go into this because it's very intricate and far from conclusive, is we're trying to come up with ways to represent mental models of mechanisms that are more dynamic. All the other models I've talked about are fairly static networks. They're structured like narratives. They're structured by explanations for the individual people. If I'd gone into the category concepts, they're structured by culturally induced beliefs about category structure. But they're all pretty static, and they can be summarized with little network graphs. Now we're trying to come up with a way, you know, I just got bored with the static mental models, with some consistent way to describe dynamic models. And we think a variation on sort of an urn image for a Markov process is a way to describe those. But this is very science fiction-y. We don't have strong evidence for this at all. But we're working on the how are more dynamic explanations represented. An interesting point, though. Back in World War II, there was another Italian lottery that was funny. In this case, the number, the number 8 was the odd number, and it didn't come up for an even longer time than number 53. But the population generated an explanation of it. They said, and they came up with almost, they came up with definitely superstitious explanations for why Mussolini had fixed the lottery so that number 8 wouldn't come up, why he wouldn't want number 8. And they didn't show that gambler's fallacy effect in that case because they'd explained it away with a different explanation. The point is, it's how you explain it that matters. Okay, I'm going to skip to the chase. What I meant to do in this talk was talk about several kinds of mental representations that are all driven by how people explain causal relations and events. The best developed and the most convincing case is the juror judgments case. I'm going to skip my punchline about how should fields work together and why cognitive psychology is the central field that's going to help fields interact. It's just basically a sales pitch for why the cognitive analysis that I described at the beginning is important. So let me try to prove to you that mental representations cause decisions and in turn cause behaviors. So what we have is a classic Necker cube problem. And Necker cubes are stimuli that are interesting because they can be represented one way or another. You can imagine the cube is coming out to the upside or coming down to the downside. This is an ambiguous sign. But I'm sure if we could take a snapshot of your nervous system or your cognitive representation, that if you represented this sign and unitized it that way, you'd head that way for gate 8, and if you unitized it this way, you'd head that way to gate 8. I think this is a sort of a metaphorical proof that mental representation causes decision and action. Okay, enough of that. If you have questions or...
This has been a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.